Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I have with me a very, very accomplished doctor turned entrepreneur from North Carolina, USA, Dr. Jenny Byrne. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Byrne is a physician leader, brain and behavior specialist. She's an entrepreneur and she's an author. And all of you know, I'm very partial to authors. So her book, which is on promotion right now on Amazon, is Work Smart, Brain Behavior, Creativity, and the Future of Work. And we will talk about Dr. Byrne's book. So Jenny, let's start by asking you a question about your own amazing journey in the world of healthcare. And that has led you to becoming an entrepreneur.
Yeah, so I've had some time to kind of reflect on this. You know, it's definitely a journey. It's not a linear path, right? As you know, it meanders quite a bit. And I think for me, two things have really stood out. Mm-hmm. The first is, you know, going back to when I was a kid, I've always been a very creative person, but I've always been a science person. So mm-hmm. I had this weird dichotomy, and most people in school thought, well, you should be kind of one or the other. But I found that the creative side, whether it's being a musician or doing other art, really feeds the science. And the more I read about creativity and science, the more I learned how they actually go together. So I think one theme has been kind of how to tap into creativity as a business person or a scientist. And really, it's not something separate. It's a different way that your brain can work to really help you in whatever you choose to do. So that's been kind of a big theme I've really reflected on. Mm-hmm. And then the other has been, like many entrepreneurs, I just like to fix things. You know, if I'm working in a system, I immediately start thinking how it can be better.
Okay.
So, you know, I started in research and I was like, you know, I immediately saw how clinicians needed the research. And so I was like, okay, let me go do an MD PhD. Mm-hmm. And then I immediately saw, like, wow, we could really fix this problem. And so I went and started my own business, a psychiatry practice.
Okay.
And then in the practice, I was like, we can do better. And I kept trying new things, which were a little bit ahead of the curve, you know, 5-10 years ahead of the trend. So every stage, I think, of being an entrepreneur, I have this deep desire to kind of fix things and use that creativity to fuel the next thing.
Amazing. Amazing. And what is it like to move from being a practicing doctor to becoming an entrepreneur?
Oh my gosh. It is like totally different cognitive processes. Mm-hmm. So I did not have an entrepreneurial family. I do have a sister who actually had her own small business when she was very young in her 20s. Mm-hmm. So I had seen it a little bit. But wow, no, it is totally different. I think one of the things that really stood out to me were the operational component of business. That was the first thing I really had to learn, because as a physician, you know, you're normally in a health system where the operations, you don't really see a lot of it happening. It kind of happens. And then the patient comes in the room with you and your job is to sit with them in the room and make those decisions. So I think learning how to do operations was like a huge learning curve that I had to learn. Mm-hmm. And then the next learning curve was really about the finance and the business, how to do all of that. And I'll be honest with you, like I had no idea what I was doing. And I really learned very quickly. And when you are a small business owner, as many entrepreneurs are, you know, the bank account is your bank account.
Correct.
So when payroll comes, if you need to pay payroll, like that's you. There's no corporate structure behind you. You know, entrepreneurs, that's really painful. And you know, in North Carolina, it doesn't snow very much. And we had a week where it snowed and the city shut down for 2 weeks and we had no income, no revenue, and payroll was due, you know, and I had to get out my bank account. And when you learn those lessons, like that's so emotionally painful that I feel like as an entrepreneur, sometimes you learn things in a more emotional way than others. So the lessons really stick. So I had to learn the operations. I had to learn the finance. And then my biggest challenge in some ways was surprising was learning how to manage people. And I had this idea that doctors were these professionals and they didn't need management. You know, you just let them alone and they'll do great. And obviously that's not true. They're human just like everybody else. And learning how to manage them, that was my first challenge in like people management, which I went on to do more of later. But the people side of it, you know, as a psychiatrist, you'd think I was great at that, but working with patients is different than working with staff and figuring out how I could took what I knew from psychiatry and therapy into people management. That was a really interesting challenge.
Amazing. Amazing. And, you know, I resonate with everything that you've been saying, because for when I moved, and I should have known better, from the corporate world into becoming an entrepreneur, I faced a lot of those challenges.
Yeah.
From a medical practice to an entrepreneur, the challenges would have been even greater. But let's now talk a little bit about mental health.
Sure.
What are some of the major mental health challenges we are now facing in the world? And this could be probably because of the pandemic as well.
So I think definitely the pandemic has exacerbated things, but most of the issues we're seeing were there. People just weren't paying attention.
Okay.
I mean, psychiatrists were paying attention, but most, you know, people weren't, because mental health has always been very stigmatized.
Correct.
It's very heated debate. If you go back in the history of medicine, it's heated debate over what is mental illness, what is not, what is cultural, what is not. There's always been this very hot debate around psychiatry. So it's very stigmatized. So people didn't talk about it for the most part, right? I mean, my family didn't talk about it. So even though things like depression, anxiety, adult ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, these things are very highly prevalent in most populations globally, in India as well as in the US, people didn't talk about it. And you talked about the ones that were very visible. So people with like schizophrenia, who are psychotic, right, with delusions and hallucinations, that's very visible. You can kind of see their symptoms. And so we talked about that, but we didn't talk about all the other stuff. So I think it was always there. We just weren't talking about it. And we most of the time weren't treating it. Statistics show that in the US, you know, if 10 people have depression, only two really get treatment.
Wow.
So we just weren't taking care of it. So what I see in the younger generation, you know, people in their teens, 20s, 30s, like they're very open about talking about mental health in a way that I'm older than that, obviously. Yeah. My generation is not, you know, we still don't really talk about it as much. And so I think there's a big cultural shift in terms of seeing mental health as a key part of who you are as a person, which I'm happy to see. The challenge is that the resources haven't caught up. So psychiatrists, psychotherapists, all, you know, we're in very short supply, I think in India as well, but globally, we're just in short supply. So we haven't really caught up to that yet.
But, you know, it is reassuring to hear from you that the younger people are at least beginning to address this as a challenge. Because I was speaking to some, and their logic was that, you know, if you're willing to speak about your heart and your diabetes and your lungs, the brain is just another organ. But
yeah, again, there's this fascinating history, because, you know, philosophically, there's discussion about, you know, what is the soul, or what is consciousness, or what is makes us as individuals, and is that in the brain? Is it spiritual? Is it both? Is it something else? So it's this very existential thing, whereas most people don't feel like their heart functioning is very existential. Maybe they should, but they don't.
I agree with you. So my next question to you, Jenny, is at what stage should an individual understand or realize that they need treatment?
That's a wonderful question. The way we think about most mental illness is that it's on a spectrum. And it's not like binary, like you have it or you don't. Experiencing depression is a normal part of being a human. Expressing anxiety is like a normal part of being a human. It's when it crosses the line and it starts to impact your life in a negative way. So for example, panic attacks are very common. One out of three people will have a panic attack in their lifetime. But it's not a disorder unless you have frequent panic attacks. They're making you avoid going out in public. You are afraid to go do things because you think you're going to have a panic attack, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say if you notice there's a period of time that's approximately, overgeneralizing here, but 2 weeks mm-hmm. or longer, where you're like, wow, I've been really depressed for like more than 2 weeks, or I've been really anxious for like more than 2 weeks, and I kind of can't get out of it. I think it's the duration and the intensity when you should start doing a little research and maybe ask for help. So not all depression, anxiety is mental illness, of course. But if it goes on for a really long time, more than a couple of weeks, and it's like, I'm not functioning well, you know, at home or at work, that's when normally I would encourage somebody to reach out.
Interesting. And a follow-up question to that is, what are the symptoms a parent should be watching out for?
Oh, this is, and I'm a parent. I have teenagers, and this was hard for me. You know, as somebody who's trained in this, it was still really hard for me during the pandemic to kind of keep an eye on the kids' mental health. I think what for kids, looking at changes in their behavior, sometimes it's not like what they say that comes out of their mouth, but more like their behavior. Obviously, grades dropping is one that you can see. Kids like looking more withdrawn, less eye contact, not wanting to talk to people, getting really irritable. Noticing their sleep patterns have dramatically changed. Like they're sleeping way less, way more. They're not eating the same. They're eating less. They're eating more. Energy level, they seem like they're just dragging through their day. So for kids, sometimes it's not what they say. It's more about their behavior. But if a kid says to you, hey, I think I'm depressed, take it really seriously. Because like I said earlier, they're more open to talk about these things. So don't blow it off. Don't say, oh, well, you know, you're just a teenager. You know, all teenagers are depressed. Like, just take a minute and listen, really, really listen and ask good questions. If they come to you and say that, like, please do take it seriously.
Interesting. And when you now go to the other part of the spectrum, which is the elderly.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of brain-related challenges a lot of elderly are facing, you know, whether it's an Alzheimer's, dementia or something. But what about challenges of mental health in the elderly?
Another great question. And the, like you said, the brain is part of the body, right? So as we age, our brain ages.
Correct.
The way our body does. Happily, we're learning that nerve cells in our brain called neurons can be plastic, meaning they can change even as we age. So the good news is, we can still have a positive impact on the way our brain works, even when we're older. The downside is all the things that your brain kind of lives in can be impacted by age. For example, your brain needs a lot of blood flow. It needs a lot of sugar. So if you have vascular disease and your blood vessels are, you know, have cholesterol plaques in them, your brain is not going to get the blood that it needs to function well. So by taking care of your heart and your blood vessels, you're also taking care of your brain, because the blood vessels could brain, right?
Correct.
Similarly with your immune system. If you take good care of your immune system, your brain will not get inflamed, because your brain is part of that system. So a lot of the things that people can do as they age are really things that take care of their body will also help take care of their brain. It's not independent. So dementia or cognitive impairment is very common when you get older. And it's because often the brain has suffered some damage. So whether that's your blood vessels aren't bringing in enough blood, you don't have enough blood sugar, you have inflammatory things going on, the reserves of your brain go down. So you're more prone under strain to have problems with your mood, with your cognition. So for example, when older people were getting ill with, like, say, COVID or the flu or things like that, your brain reserves are much smaller because they're under strain. So sometimes cognitive impairment or depression or anxiety will come out more when you're physically ill, because your brain has less reserves. So it's all about, like, how much reserves can you have so that as your brain ages, you can still function, you know, the best that you want to.
Amazing. So one more question, and then I'll move to your book. Over the last 4 or 5 decades, how has technology changed the work that you do, and how has it made it easier for patients?
You have the best questions. Thank you. So I would say, I'll put on two different hats to answer that question. If I put on my physician hat, my doctor hat, we're kind of lagging. You know, technology is a little bit behind, to be honest. There's a lot of reasons for that. We're starting to see a real wave of tech products that are there to help patients get better care, but we're kind of behind. You know, a lot of doctors, we're still using paper charts. I know doctors who still use paper charts, believe it or not. So getting technology into the day-to-day workflow of seeing patients is pretty far behind. You'll notice a lot of doctors still don't text patients. We're far behind. There's regulatory reasons for some of that. Healthcare, especially in the US, is a heavily regulated space. But I'd say tech is pretty far behind, but there's so much coming. So there's this giant wave of tech that's coming to healthcare, you know, in the next couple years, I would say.
Okay.
Now put on my entrepreneur hat and answer the question. Being an entrepreneur, I think logistically is way easier than it was when I started like 15 years ago. You know, I remember starting and like just getting a website up and going was like 5 months and all my budget. And like, it was very complicated. And now I can do it in 20, I can literally do it in like 20 minutes for $20.
Yeah.
And it looks decent. Or managing client relationships like CRMs. Back when I started 15 years ago, like that was a whole big thing. Now, again, you can pull up one and get going very quickly. So, and the world of virtual assistants, you know, I think that's a whole space. I just got a new virtual assistant who's on the other side of the world. I can have assistants anywhere in the world, you know? So I think being an entrepreneur, the logistics behind it are actually a lot easier. And I see a lot more entrepreneurship in my community. So I feel very optimistic that the entrepreneur world, actually the tech is there and operating very smoothly. In medicine, it's still slow. And I think there's a lot of resistance to it, and there's a lot of regulation too.
Correct. Well said. So now let me move to your book. You know, your book,
sure.
Work Smart, Brain Behavior, Creativity, and the Future of Work. Let me check first ask you that it's available, I'm assuming, on Amazon.
Yeah, the book is on Amazon, ebook, paperback, hardcover, and I will do an audiobook probably in about 6 months.
Okay. And before I ask you about the book, I'm going to ask all our viewers and listeners to go and check out Dr. Jenny Byrne's book on Amazon. I will go and check it out myself.
Thank you.
And then, of course, you take a call. So now tell me, what was your hypothesis when you started to write this book?
So the you know, I mentioned at the beginning that I'm somebody that I just see, I want to fix things, and I get excited and I start researching, and that's kind of how the book happened. I was trying to figure out what's the new way of working? How do I work with my clients? We're distributed, we're not in person. Things are different. How do we do this thing, you know? And looking around, and there were no answers. I didn't like the answers I was seeing. They weren't helpful. So I started doing my own research through my lens, which is kind of brain and behavior, entrepreneur. And what I found really surprised me. And so I decided I really needed to share this, because we're all still, years later since the pandemic started, and we're still struggling. And so my thesis is really that everybody thinks the future of work is about better technology, but I believe it's about being a better human. So my main thesis is, by understanding how human beings work, we can infuse a lot more humanism into work. Let the robots help us. Let the robots do robot stuff. So the humans can do human stuff, because I think that's what we're all really craving. And the pandemic really showed us that we're all craving human connection. We're all craving empathy. I would say even kindness. We're really craving that. And technology isn't going to bring us that. That's really humanism, understanding how human beings work, and helping make take small steps now that are very easy and practical that go a long way to making people feel like human beings at work. We don't want to feel it. Most people really don't want to be a robot at work. I don't want to be a robot at work. I want to be a person.
And I guess we'll have enough robots to do the work that robots are meant to do, but to let the thinking by human.
And the example, the story I give an example is that, you know, there are ride services like Uber and Lyft, right? Mm-hmm. So used to be a taxi driver, their job was they had to drive around, they had to find people, they had to have know all the directions, they had to take payment. They had all these things they had to do, right? So you get in the cab and that's what they would do. Now Uber and Lyft have let robots do all that work. Mm-hmm. Now the driver's job is to make you feel good as a rider. Maybe that's sitting quietly in a tidy car, maybe that's chatting with you, but they want those stars, right? So they're trying to be more human and give you what you need as a human being, because that's what they're incentivized to do. Let the robots make the directions and the payment and let the robots do that stuff. They're there to make the human part better. And so that's what I think we can do in our work in general.
So one more question related to this is that, you know, when you talk of the future of work, how are you linking the future of work to your area of specialization, which is mental health?
So again, my lens is through the brain and behavior, human brain and behavior. So for example, let's take Zoom. We're on Zoom doing this interview, right? We're on a televideo platform. What I know about human brains tells me that we have cells in our brains called face cells that are primed to see human faces.
Okay.
So practically speaking, if I'm on Zoom and I have that Hollywood square with like 20 people, that is going to trigger alarm signals in my brain, because I'm seeing all these faces. It's triggering all this and I get exhausted. And so when people talk about Zoom fatigue after a day of Zoom, that's what they're talking about. Their brain is like totally overwhelmed and exhausted. So a practical tip is don't look at Hollywood squares. Turn that off. I have you on a speaker mode. You know, if we had a room of people, I'd put you on speaker mode. Another tip and trick is don't have your self view on. Your face, your brain also has mirror cells. You can't not look at yourself.
Correct.
It's impossible. Have you ever tried to walk past a mirror and not look at yourself? Like, it's very hard.
Yeah.
So if you have self-view on, your brain is going to make you look at yourself. And for people who feel scrutinized at work, and often women and underrepresented groups feel very scrutinized in particular, that's very distressing for your brain as well. So turn it off.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting.
So these are very practical things in our day-to-day work that we just don't even think about. You know, we just assume things and we don't think. But if you just take a moment and you think about the human body and brain, it's easy to see where making tweaks can make you just feel a lot better at work.
Very interesting. And my last question to you now, Jenny, and this is for the many, many people who will listen to our conversation. Based on your own amazing journey, you know, as a healthcare as a doctor, as an entrepreneur, someone who specialized in mental health, what would you say are three lessons or three learnings you would want our viewers and listeners to take away from our conversation?
Well, that's a great question. So I think my first takeaway is a little bit what we said at the beginning, that your brain is part of your body and your body is part of your brain. Existential spirituality aside, taking care of your body takes care of your brain. Taking care of your brain takes care of your body.
Yeah.
So I firmly believe that the two are closely intertwined.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. The second big takeaway I would say is being a better human at work or at home. You mentioned about like what about with kids in particular? Listening is really hard. Like actually listening to other people and being an active listener is hard. And if you can master that, being a good listener, your relationships will be much deeper and your work will be better.
Yeah.
So I talk about that in the book, but being a good listener, I think, is the other one.
Yeah.
And then my final thing would be, as I mentioned before, I think what we're all craving is humanism. We're craving connection, whatever that means. It doesn't have to mean being at parties all day long. It can mean connecting through art, you know, reading a book that connects you with a different human from 500 years ago. But we're craving the sense of human connection. That's what I think most of us are missing. And there are ways that we can infuse more humanism into what we do. And they're not expensive. Indra Nooji is a great example of an Indian, you know, superstar who does this with such grace and infuses humanism into her work. And I cite her in the book. So the idea that like infusing humanism, it's not always hard, it's not always expensive, but we just don't think about it in business, especially.
Fascinating. And on that note, and your three amazing lessons, your brain is part of your body and vice versa, look after your body well, be a better human being, listen well, because listening is so, so critical for us to connect with people. And third one you said was that we all crave connections, and therefore infuse more humanism into our lives.
Yes.
Thank
yes.
you, Jenny, for speaking to me about your own amazing journey, about so many amazing things that I have learned to you from you today on the subject of mental health. Thank you for talking to me about your challenges as you move from being a physician or a doctor, becoming an entrepreneur. And, you know, I think everyone faces that, but nobody is willing to recognize that. And finally, thank you so much for speaking to me about your book, Work Smart, Brain Behavior, Creativity, and the Future of Work. Thank you again, and good luck.
Thank you. It's so fun to be here with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.